Today on Maine Calling, Washington Post columnist and spy novelist David Ignatius. You may know David Ignatius as the familiar face and voice on the Sunday morning news program circuit, or for his columns on national and international affairs in the Washington Post. But Ignatius also has a following as a spy novelist, who draws from his reporting knowledge on the intelligence community to craft forward-looking plots that could be taken directly from future headlines. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program, we'll talk with Ignatius about his new thriller, Phantom Orbit, and about the actual international tensions playing out in space today. We'll get his take on the latest developments in the wars in the Middle East and Ukraine, and on the rise of the right in Europe. And as always, we want to hear from you. A conversation with David Ignatius. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to island and coastal Downeys communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. The new thriller by David Ignatius, Phantom Orbit, reads like something taken from the headlines. It centers on a Russian satellite scientist who becomes a pawn in the shadowy world of world power espionage. Anyone familiar with the work of Ignatius won't be surprised by the insider knowledge on the pages of the novel. He's an award-winning reporter and editor and writes a foreign affairs column for the Washington Post. David Ignatius joins us for the hour to talk about writing thrillers and to share his insights into global and national affairs in the news. And of course, we want to hear from you. Are you a fan of spy novels and thrillers? What questions do you have about current events, either at home or abroad? Email talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. David Ignatius, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
We have so much to get to in this hour, including your novel, of course. But I want to get first to your take on what's happening or not happening in Gaza right now. The UN Security Council this week passed a U.S. drafted ceasefire deal aimed at halting months of violence there. But you've learned Israel has its own plan in mind. Could you just tease out for us like where we're at with this?
So it's painful to say because this war has been so terribly costly to Palestinian civilians, to Israelis, and we dearly hope that an end can be negotiated. I think there is an impasse in the deal that President Biden has worked so hard to get a ceasefire, which is that Hamas is demanding a permanent ceasefire in writing. It wants an assurance, a timetable about exactly when hostilities cease totally and Israeli troops withdraw. And Israel hasn't really changed its basic goal of demilitarizing Hamas. For as long as that takes, Israel is committed that Hamas will not govern Gaza again. So we have a deeper impasse here than I think people realize, one that can't easily be compromised. And my fear is that the war, as horrible as it is going to continue, I hope in much diminished form. There are plans that both Israel and the U.S. have been working on to provide a framework for de-escalation, even if you don't have a formal ceasefire agreement.
One plan that I read about that Israel, I believe, has some support within the leadership of Israel is this goes by the shorthand name of humanitarian bubbles. This would be an after the sort of the strategy toward creating stability in Gaza once hostilities ended there. Can you talk about that? What does that mean?
So the Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, outlined humanitarian bubbles in an interview with me several weeks ago. I wrote about it in detail in my column this week. So essentially the idea is that in areas that are largely cleared of Hamas fighters, these are areas mostly in northern Gaza, northern areas of Gaza City, the IDF would establish, the Israeli Defense Forces would establish a perimeter, and then that perimeter would be defended by Palestinian security people who would be under the control of a local governing council that would be made up of leading families, merchants, trade associations, municipalities. They would, in theory, have support from some kind of international force, and they might even hire Western contractors. There are all sorts of contractors now that provide security in the way that we famously, infamously, Blackwater used to provide. The problem with this idea is that I think it's fundamentally unrealistic. What I wrote this week is that it's almost describing a gated community in an imaginary suburb that is so far from the reality of Gaza today that I just don't think it's realistic. It also reminds me and many Americans who've looked at this plan of the U.S. idea for strategic hamlets during the Vietnam War, where you'd make a village secure and then expand that perimeter. It's a very similar idea. So there's skepticism that that will work. The alternative is to have international support for much broader version of that that would provide UN Security Council resolution for legitimacy, a governing council that would have a kind of formal stamp of approval, and then a security force to be determined. But those are, I think, the avenues that people are thinking about. Unfortunately, we're some distance from them actually being implemented.
And part of the problem with this notion of having, you know, the Palestinian leaders play a role in, you know, creating the stability is that many of those leaders just don't have the support anymore, right? They're not in a position of power or respect.
So the Israel's view is that neither Hamas nor Israel should control Gaza in the future. So then you're left the question of who will control it? What will be the governing political authority? And Americans say, almost by definition, that's going to have to be some version of the Palestinian Authority, which is based in the West Bank and Ramallah, and is, in a sense, the legitimate governing presence for Palestinians. The problem is that they have been absent from Gaza in all but name. They still have a nominal role. They pay civil servants, but they have no real power in Gaza. And I think the Israelis just don't trust that they would be able to keep order in Gaza in the future. Also, the Israelis fear, I can't assess this, but that Palestinians still believe that Hamas will continue to govern Gaza indefinitely. And as I said earlier, that simply doesn't accord with Israel's mission in this war. So again, I hate to be too pessimistic, but we have an impasse here.
There's also this new aggression from Hezbollah to the north. Does this mean that Israel can maintain, if this were to escalate, maintain these two fronts, or would it be a motivator for Israel to settle the Gaza situation in order to focus then on what may be coming from the north with Hezbollah?
So my American and Israeli sources both tell me that Israel would like to downshift, is the word that one person used, the Gaza war, precisely because the potentially more urgent issue is the intensity of rocket exchanges across the Lebanese border. Israelis who lived in villages along that northern since October 7 have had to live elsewhere. Begins in September. There's a feeling that those kids who live there have to go home, go back to their schools, get started again. So there is a clock running for Israel to get some kind of agreement or, by force of arms, push Hezbollah back. One really painful aspect of this is that there is a deal that's been negotiated with the U.S. as mediator with the Lebanese government, but that means really with Hezbollah, for withdrawals from the border in exchange for limits on Israeli forces. But that agreement, as important as it is, will only take effect once the Gaza war ends. And Hamas, in refusing to accept the deal the U.S. is offering, prevents that from happening. So it's just everything's stuck in every direction. But there is a way to resolve Lebanon without another war across that border once the Gaza conflict is resolved.
We see in the headlines these efforts by the Biden administration to influence Israelis' direction in this and to end the conflict. Some say not quickly enough or not strongly enough. But clearly, the U.S. does have influence, right, to exact its desires on Israel, on other foreign entities. Has Netanyahu been the tough one to sort of convince or to nudge in this case in directions the U.S. is seeking?
So I've found that for many months now, there's been agreement between the Israeli defense and security establishment and the U.S. about a path forward towards what we call the day after. Their plans are different in some details from the U.S. plans, but they've accepted for months that you need to wind the war down, that total victory is not realistic, that you need to adjust strategy. Netanyahu resists that, continues specifically to call for total victory. That's the slogan that he uses over and over, in part because his government is maintained in a coalition with very right-wing parties with a very strong presence from settlers who live in the West Bank. And so I think, again, that's part of the blockage. There's a real split in Israel about what to do. Netanyahu hangs on. Benny Gantz, who is the leader of the opposition, who polls show is more popular than Netanyahu, would probably win an election, just left the war cabinet, undermining the Netanyahu government. But, it's probably a long time before there are elections. So it's yet one. In every direction you look at present with a government to the de-escalation that I think is desperately needed. I mean, the situation on the ground in Gaza is a nightmare. It's got to end. But how to end it, for all the reasons that we've been talking about, is just exceedingly difficult. I hand it to the Biden administration for sticking with it, but unfortunately, they're not getting to where they want to be.
And do you think even if the official conflict, the war, is ended in some way, the bloodshed will not end immediately?
So I think what needs to be admitted, just for the sake of being honest with people, is that Israel, and by this I don't just mean Netanyahu, I mean a broad consensus of Israelis, have not given up the goal of demilitarization of Hamas. What happened on October 7 is a living, vivid, fever dream in the minds of every Israeli. They don't ever want it to happen again, and that the only assurance that they feel they can get is that Hamas is effectively demilitarized. It doesn't mean it's obliterated. They understand they're not going to kill every Hamas fighter, but that goal of demilitarization is something, obviously, that if you're Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas, you don't want to be demilitarized. You don't want to be effectively neutered as a political force. So, people who expect Israel to give that goal up, I think, are unrealistic.
What do you think will be the, this is a difficult question, I acknowledge, but the lasting effect will be on the divisions that we've seen here in the United States created by this conflict in Israel and Gaza? People taking to the streets, clearly very deep divisions and powerful feelings all the way around. Will this, even if the conflict ends at some point soon, what are the lasting effects here on the U.S. internally?
So we've seen a degree of polarization about Israel-Palestine issues that I have never seen in my life. I've been covering this for 44 years. I started in 1980 covering the Middle East. I think the divisions will persist if the United States can effectively be a mediator and can find a way to de-escalate this conflict and bring an acceptable solution. I think that requires a realistic assessment in Israel that some of their goals are not achievable, even if long-term demilitarization of Hamas remains something they won't back down from. If the U.S. can do that, then I think it ought to bring the country back together, and people should be proud that we played the historic role. I mean, for goodness sakes, we brought peace between Israel and Egypt, between Israel and Jordan, between Israel and the UAE. That's what we've done. That's our gift. So somehow we've got to exercise that again. And if we can, it ought to, I think a lot of the temperature should be lowered, and I hope people come back together.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking with David Ignatius. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. My guest today, Washington Post columnist and best-selling author David Ignatius. He has a new spy thriller out called Phantom Orbit, and we're talking about the book and about his take on major world events in the news. Share your comments and questions. Email talk@mainepublic.org, comment on our Facebook page or Instagram, or give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. I want to go now to Ukraine. President Biden and President Zelensky will sign a bilateral security agreement at the G7 summit in Italy, and this is a deal to find a way to provide Ukraine with up to $50 billion, which is backed by frozen Russian assets. What does that deal look like? Do we have a sense of how the money would move?
So it's my understanding that of the Russian sovereign assets that were frozen when the war began, and I think that total is something like $300 billion. They're held mostly in European banks. So Europe's agreement on a solution is necessary. But in effect, to collateralize loans to Ukraine that will be used by Ukraine to help pay the cost of reconstruction, pay the cost of fighting off the Russian illegal invasion. Interest on that money that's being held in escrow, in effect, will similarly be used almost as an advance to Ukraine on what it would be paid in reparations, presumably, once the war ends. So that's the idea, is not to touch the principal. There are many people in the international financial community who believe that would just be too destabilizing. If sovereign assets can simply be seized, they're not sovereign anymore. Everybody's assets would be called into question. But the idea is that they could be used while they're parked and frozen for this purpose. The U.S. is on board. The Treasury Department's been pushing it. I was told today by a Treasury official that they think there will be agreement in the next day or so on a plan pretty much the way I just described it.
So that money, in addition to the $60 billion approved by the U.S. finally for Ukraine, what does that all add up to, do you think, in terms of Ukraine's chances for having enough defensive capability to at least put on a long and arduous defense?
So I think, Keith, the goal the U.S. has had going into this G7 summit is to assure Ukraine that there will be continuity of support regardless of political changes in the United States or Europe. The big political change in the U.S. obviously could be the election of former President Trump in November, but there are many possible political changes in Europe ahead, too. And the idea is to build a framework both in terms of money for weapons and reconstruction through the two channels you mentioned, the $60 billion that Congress passed and whatever money comes out of this sovereign debt device to give that continuity. So you can say to Ukraine, going forward for a long while, through 2025, maybe beyond, you can depend on having support. And that's important, obviously, for Ukrainian morale. It's also an important message to Russia. If you think you can just wait this out and choke off the Ukrainians and hope and pray that Donald Trump gets elected, then it's all going to go away. No, that's not going to work. That's the idea that they're trying to put together at the summit.
Meanwhile, Russian Navy ships made their way into Havana Harbor this week, which many interpret as kind of a show of something to the Biden administration by Vladimir Putin. What is Putin saying with that presence?
So Putin's getting more and more adept at saber rattling. He and his former President Medvedev talk with chilling regularity about using tactical nuclear weapons if pushed to the wall in Ukraine. I think sending ships in the Havana Harbor is similarly, it's deliberately meant to recall the worst of the Cold War days, this Cuban Missile Crisis. It's a very deliberate attempt to scare the West. I think increasingly there's a view among U.S. officials that although you have to take Russian threats, you don't want to discount them. But a lot of this is for show, for the domestic public, trying to rattle the U.S. and Europe. I don't see anybody treating this as a casus belli, a reason for a new crisis over Cuba.
But if it's theater, then, does it reflect, do you think, a sort of maybe Putin's motivation for his desire for Ukraine? You know, some argue, well, he's after Ukraine's natural resources or to fend off, NATO influence in the region. But do you think that there's something grander, more ideological behind Putin wanting to retake Ukraine? Does this have something to do with some sort of personal vision for Russia?
Yes. So I think Putin is obsessed with Ukraine. I think if you read his writings, the long essay he wrote in 2021 when he was locked up during COVID and brooding about Ukraine and said Ukraine doesn't exist as a real country, you see that he just is all in. Every time he's challenged on this war, he basically doubles down, and he is committed for the long run. He sees this as a moment when Russia can assert its leading strategic, I want to say dominant strategic role in Europe. He thinks he can intimidate the Europeans if he just sticks at it. Appears to be as popular as ever in Russia, I'm sorry to say. I'd love to say the Russians are getting sick of this. They think their leader's losing it with this Ukraine obsession. I think a lot of Russians do believe that, but Putin is no less popular, or he's more popular probably now than when the war began. So, that's one problem. Keith, when I go to Ukraine, I always ask Ukrainians, who's your real enemy? Is it Putin or is it Russia? And increasingly, I've heard it's Russia, meaning it's not just Putin. He has the support of the Russian people. You know, he may be obsessed with this personally in an unusual way, but the country as a whole just has this sense of grievance, has a chip on its shoulder, feels the West is against Russia, doesn't understand Russia. So I think that's, if analysts out at the CIA think deeply about Russia, worry about the trajectory over the next few decades, is this Russia that's so sullen, so angry, feels excluded from the West, turns toward China. What's that country going to be like? And I think they're right to worry about that.
You have said you see this Ukraine, the war in Ukraine, as the first space war. And this was based on visits you made to Ukraine where you kind of witnessed the central role that technology was playing. Can you explain why it's the first space war?
So, Keith, this was really one of the motivations for me in writing my new novel, Phantom Orbit. I felt the book is about space weapons, space warfare. I felt we were watching the first space war happen without realizing it. And the reason I say that is that from the very beginning, Ukraine has been absolutely dependent on U.S. space systems for its ability to fight back the Russians. Without Starlink broadband connectivity, essentially providing Wi-Fi over eastern Ukraine, Ukrainian frontline forces couldn't communicate with headquarters. They couldn't download the coordinates to attack Russian tanks as they were moving forward. Similarly, the Russians have learned that space war, space systems are their biggest danger, have gotten much better at electronic warfare to jam signals from satellites. I was told recently that they're now able to jam often Starlink signals, cutting off that signaling. They're regularly able to jam GPS signals so that U.S. weapons like HIMARS missiles that depend on GPS and other satellite signals to coordinate their precision targeting aren't effective. So the Russians are toe-to-toe in this, and they've even gone the next step, which is to say weapons in space are so dangerous for us, we need a weapon system that can disable everything that's up there if we're in a real crisis. You may remember back in February, Mike Turner, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, demanded a briefing from the White House about the new Russian super threat. Well, that super threat was a plan to use a nuclear weapon to take out the satellites in low Earth orbit, like Elon Musk's Starlink, and render them ineffective. So, yeah, we are. This there is a way in which this is the first space war. I think it's really, it's very dangerous. I know the Pentagon is waking up to it. I worry that the American public just doesn't really have a sense yet of how important these space systems are.
Well, maybe that's because it's 2 years out, and that's how you. That's how you plan your novels. But before we get to your novel next, I did want to ask one follow-up here. You mentioned Starlink and the central role that it's playing. So it's a commercial entity playing a central role in this war. Elon Musk is actually a significant figure in the war in this way.
So, yeah, I mean, Elon Musk is as important as any general in this war, and it illustrates the way in which the U.S., as we have our national security increasingly interwoven with private companies, depends on those private companies. What happens when Elon Musk says one morning, sorry, but the Chinese market's more important to me than Ukraine. I can't, my company can't afford this commitment to Ukraine, and decides to pull the plug. What does the U.S. do? You can go down the list. Ukraine has depended on Microsoft to identify Russian attacks on its cyber systems, see them coming before they come. I mean, Ukraine would have been devastated in the 24 hours before the war began back in February 2022, if Microsoft hadn't seen an attack coming, told Ukraine and allowed Ukraine to get its systems safely into servers that were outside Ukraine, couldn't be damaged. So if those private companies, you know, which are in effect crucial instruments of U.S. Foreign policy strategy, decide they're not on board or that they're international companies, then we have a real problem. And I don't hear, I think, again, there's a problem that people are just beginning to think about. Our companies are so incredibly inventive. What an asset for the United States. But is it one that that the Pentagon can rely on 100% going forward? I mean, I just don't know what the answer to that is.
And maybe the public's just not aware because we don't see these satellites. Although I have seen Starlink passing through the sky. It's quite a surprising vision. But you've always sort of planned your novels 2 years out. You thought you would think, well, what's going to be front and center in 2 years? And that's the case with Phantom Orbit. Tell us about the character and kind of how the book opens, and we'll start there and then get into a little bit about the story.
So the novel opens with a Russian astrophysicist, works for a prominent research institute in Moscow. In this time, right now, during the Ukraine war, who sees what he believes is evidence that Russia and China have developed what he thinks of as a kill switch that can turn off the GPS system worldwide, which would have crippling effects on every aspect of the U.S. economy. We don't realize it, but every time we take out our cell phone and use it, it's positioning itself against four GPS satellites. That's how, you know, the system knows where the phone is on Earth. So it would affect our communications. Every time we get on an airplane, obviously it's flying thanks to satellite navigation. In fact, everything we do in our cars, we all know GPS navigation, and that's just the beginning. So he is worried enough about it that he decides he has to share this information with the CIA, uses the CIA website, which any of your listeners can go to, and CIA.gov or whatever it is. And there's a little invitation to people around the world in different languages. If you know information that's important, here's where to send it securely. So he does that, sends off this warning that your satellites can't be trusted, that they can be frozen, that north can turn into south, but the Russian sends off that message. And to his astonishment, there's no answer from the CIA. Why is that? That's one of the riddles that goes through the book. Why aren't they answering him? And then, as I'll explain if you have time.
Yeah, sure.
We pull back to the sort of early start of this character, Ivan Volkov's obsession with satellites. He's a young man. He is growing up in post-Soviet Russia. It's a mess. It's just a country of bandits. He's studying at Moscow State University. He can't afford to pay his tuition. He gets a scholarship to study in China, which is giving away scholarships at their best scientific university, Tsinghua, in Beijing. So he's studying there, comes to the attention of Chinese researchers who see that he's a brilliant person who understands some things that will be crucial for them. It's 1995. China doesn't have anything in space, but they know how important it's going to be. So that's how we kind of get the ball rolling with him. In Beijing, he meets an American woman who, unknown to him initially, has connections with the CIA, is kind of a spotter who's also a graduate student at Tsinghua. And then the plot takes us over an arc of time with these characters and others towards this moment that isn't, as I said at the beginning, it's like right now, it's during the Ukraine war, in which all these characters and their stories come together under the theme of dealing with this catastrophic threat of a kill switch that would turn off satellites.
I have a few more questions about this book and how it is taken directly from real life, but I want to bring in Peter in Yarmouth, who wants to add to the conversation, has a question about the Chinese space program. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi. Hello. Hello. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Peter.
Question, getting a little bit out of orbit, and China obviously is a little bit ahead of us, or it seems like they're ahead of us in the future space race with their landing on the far side of the moon, bring back some samples that may be very important for future space exploration. So my question to you is, what about the future of asteroid mining, both in terms of what some of the countries may be doing to compete with each other, like China, and maybe ahead of us, and then looking at these private commercial entities like Elon Musk, when there's a wealth, obviously, of materials out there, and wealth being the operative word. What do you see? Maybe that's your book 4 years out, but where do you see this is going?
Well, so I think it's a question that I haven't spent enough time studying, except to note that this is part of the new space race. There's so many different dimensions of it. The question of who owns what's on an asteroid in legal terms fascinates me. There are just so many issues we haven't really thought much about, as we really do Earth, and, you know, increasingly think of living in our solar system, not just on our planet. My boss, Jeff Bezos, has this idea that in the future we'll think of the Earth as a beautiful national park that we'll come visit from our homes further out in space. That's obviously way in the distance, but the question of asteroid mining is right up close. Who owns that stuff? How's it regulated? I don't know the answers, because I don't think anybody does.
We'll get back to this in a moment. We do have to take a quick break. We're talking with David Ignatius. We'll talk more about your book when we come back. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today, my guest is David Ignatius, Washington Post columnist and best-selling author. Give us a call, the number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. In the acknowledgement of the book Phantom Orbit, David, you say the book is kind of a love letter of sorts to Russia, or maybe what you'd like Russia to be. Can you talk about that and what it is about this Russia that you see, that you admire about the culture or values, or just explain that to us?
So what's happening to Russia is heartbreaking to me. I've visited Russia often during the Soviet Union days, in the post-Soviet time, and recently. I was planning to go to Russia to do research for this novel, and my character, Ivan Volkov, I wanted him to embody the way in which Russia was crushed in the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union. He's from Russia's version of Pittsburgh, east of the Urals, big steelmaking town that just fell on terrible hard times. My character's father, Ivan says of his father that he choked on too much vodka and too many lies, like I think so much of that generation of Russians. So I was going to go to Magnitogorsk, this town. I arranged, but got my visa and all that. And along comes the Ukraine war. And I was on the first list of people who were banned from traveling to Russia. I have no idea why, but there goes my trip. I do think there's something extraordinary about Russian culture, like so many readers. I grew up with the great Russian novels. Tolstoy's Anna Karenina to me is still one of the defining books of seeing into how we think, the unforgettable chapters in that book, and so many others. So I love that Russia. I've tried to paint characters that will remind us of that Russia, but also of the just nightmarish I think tyranny of the Putin regime. There's one character who's the son of my hero Ivan, who is very courageous, who is trying his best. I won't go into the details. Want people to read them, but is struggling for a better Russia. So I think there are other people like the late heroic Alexei Navalny who are out there. I hope and pray that in the future they'll be more powerful. And this book is kind of a love letter to those people and their dreams.
What is, as a writer, as a journalist, what does fiction bring to you, to your, what does it allow you to do in terms of telling stories or creating characters that you otherwise couldn't do as just being a straight ahead, just the facts, journalist? And is that really an important part of who you are?
So it's ended up being absolutely central to my career. I love being a journalist. I love reporting. I love finding out facts. I really don't like making mistakes. So in my columns, as in my reporting, when I was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, I try to get things right. But if you're a columnist, you basically have 800, maybe 1,000 words, limited space. You have to come to a conclusion. You have to give people advice. You have to think about policy. And everything that I explore as a reporter, I find is more complicated than I can easily reduce to 800 words. So when I find a subject that really fascinates me, and space warfare was one, I just want to unpack it. I want to let it be as complicated as it is in real life. I want to find characters who will let me tell the story as people are experiencing it. I'm just lucky. That's the only way to put it, that I've been able to do both. That I get to do my journalism, still love it, but I've written now 12 novels where I was able to paint on a broader canvas and do something that's very different from journalism.
And had you not had that reporting experience and had the contacts and the, learned what you learned, your novels would be, I don't know whether you'd be a novelist or they'd be just very different, not as based in reality or in not leveraging all of that information and experience that you gained as a journalist.
So there's no question that my books are in a sense limited by I want them to be fact-based. We love crazy thrillers, James Bond. I mean, James Bond could never be based in real life. Intelligence officers don't do what James Bond does, and there aren't any villains quite like Dr. No or Goldfinger, but they're fun to read. I like to be closer to the bone, and so my novels have always been shaped by my reporting. What intelligence officers really do is meticulous. There's a lot of waiting. They're setting up the moment in which they pull the string, they execute the plot. So I've tried to just describe that. Sometimes that's slower than what most people imagine they're going to get out of a spy novel. But I think it's what life is really like. But anyway, the truth is, I couldn't write books any different after I tried. I've had 12 attempts. But I write the books that I know how to write.
Paul writes asking, he's curious which authors of spy novels you like best or are influenced by.
So the John le Carré Smiley novels, I think, are brilliant. Smiley just is a character. I close my eyes and I can see him, hear him. He invented a language for thinking about intelligence operations. Lamplighters, scalp hunters, the circus. He was making up things that to allow him as a serving intelligence officer to write these books, and I think they're wonderful. I'm less of a fan of some of his non-Smiley books. I'm a Graham Greene fan. Graham Greene isn't usually thought of as a spinologist, but he was an intelligence officer. Some of his books are about intelligence very specifically, but the kind of subtle problems, moral problems that people in the spy world have to deal with are very much in Graham Greene's books. I like some of the newer novels are coming out of the CIA. David McCloskey's books, I think, are first rate. Damascus Station, I'd recommend for people. He had a book called Moscow X that I thought was interesting. But I tend, in general, Keith, to like books that are more realistic, that have fewer Aston Martins and more real spies.
So, if you're planning another novel, which we might guess you would be 2 years from now, can you tell us what it might be, what it might be centered around?
So obviously, I'm still thinking about that. I have a book in mind that is about the broad arc of the U.S.-Chinese spy wars over the last generation. I did a short version of this in the Washington Post last summer as a serial, and I'm thinking of expanding that into a full novel. The Chinese intelligence service, its skill in destroying American operations in China has been remarkable. Is not a story that people understand, and I think it's the ground of a really interesting novel. Beyond that, I've always been driven by my reporting. What reporting I'll be doing 2 years from now, I have no idea. Whether I'll still be even vertical 2 years from now is, so we'll see.
I do want to just bring it back around to the present and a story that's breaking here today about the journalist Evan Gershkovich, who has been jailed in Russia for over a year on espionage charges. The story is a Wall Street Journal reporter, and it's of interest, especially here in Maine, because he's a graduate of Bowdoin. But the Russians now say that they're revealing the details of the accusations against him and saying that he for trying to provide the CIA with information about a facility. Are you aware of sort of the latest on
I
that?
haven't read into this. I don't want to comment on it without reading carefully the details. What journalists do in countries like Russia, it inevitably involves trying to get information that the government wants to suppress. That's what we do, and I'm sure that's what Evan did. The notion that that's spying, I think, is outrageous. But I need to read what's been written.
And just you know the Russians well. I mean, what is it politically? Is this simply to embarrass? To what's the end game for these types of accusations?
So I'm hesitant to speculate. This case is so important. It's conceivable that the Russians, by outlining charges, he can't be freed until the case is resolved. So in a way, resolution, additional detail could open the door rather than close it. But I just what I, all I know is that with everybody in my profession, I think his release is something that we're united in demanding, and nothing that we've talked about changes that.
About 1 minute left. Pete writes in a small question here. Which country is the bigger threat to the US, Russia or China? In 60 seconds.
So in the long run, there's no question that it's China. Russia, although it's been ferocious, in its statements, has been unable to conquer little Ukraine. I mean, it has really gotten very, very deep into Ukraine in 2 years. So the idea that it fundamentally threatens us, it's a broken country, it's corrupt, it's still a one one resource economy. China, on the other hand, is truly a peer, something we've never really faced. It shares with us mastery of the leading technologies. It has the ambition, I think, to be a global power. It has an alternative idea of how to organize the world. So I think a war between China and the United States would be catastrophic. I want to do everything we can to avoid it. But part of that is building up our military ability to deter China.
David Ignatius, thank you for talking with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Keith. Wonderful conversation.
David Ignatius, columnist for The Washington Post and best-selling author. His latest book is Phantom Orbit. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can visit mainecalling.org for our audio archive and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Tomorrow on the program, join host Jennifer Rooks for a conversation about the right to same-sex marriage, past, present, and future. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.